Dear Edward, the other day I had a conversation with a friend and a colleague who is close to my heart, probably as close as you have at one time or another been with Ruth Benedict. It is a pity you are not alive to meet him, as you would have felt an equal affection as I do, and for sure it would have battled the feeling of being isolated in academic life, usually as the result of a humanistic approach. Nowadays, pursuing anthropology as a means of social communication seems to arouse suspicion. My friend too, same as you, could be called a humanist. In the course of his professional life, he has realized that anthropology, like many social disciplines, protects the boundaries of its own field, and in doing so, many times neglects to reveal the power structures hidden underneath its linguistic discourse. As his aim is social rather than political, he is accused of obscurantism. I think that the label applied in his case reveals a fear of an independent individual body which escapes the superorganic suggestion of a political culture. It is a fear you once believed to be Gruber's motivation for constructing the idea of culture as superorganic. My friend, however, seems rather bored with the general lust for justification and rather aims at finding as well as allowing for the expression of mixed categories in anthropology. And in this sense, he reminds me very much of you and what you once wrote to Ogburn, the sociologist, explaining... I have certain ideas about the meaning of individuality in history that I'm afraid are rather heterodox. The attempt to understand history in terms of a book formula that takes no account of the individual is, to my mind, but a passing phase in our hunger for conventional scientific capsules into which to store our concepts. When all the experiments in massed action will have brought with them their due share of inevitable disappointments, there will be a very real reaction against this whole way of thinking. But, in any event, this action is not due for some time yet, so you may as well have a laugh at me for the present. Well... this very real reaction has finally arrived. On the one hand, the scientific community still tries to laugh at it. On the other hand, it has become more and more aggressive towards fighting the implications of the proper space of individual bodies within scientific theory. As are you, my friend is affectionate and scientific at the same time, and this leads to peculiar yet vivid combinations of truth. It would not be right to say that my friend and I discussed the realms of the individual body in academic life in the United States. Rather, we thought about it, as neither one of us seems to like the idea of a consensus, for fear of losing the pleasure of our thoughts together. In terms of social attraction, nothing seems to be more important than to rediscover the desirable means to an end over and over again, listening to the whispering of the mirrors, which endlessly reflect the same things over and over. Trying to unravel their message seems to be the only way to beat the co-construction of fake oppositions, like individual and culture, rationality and emotion, science and poetry, body and mind. At a certain point in our meetings, we realized that part of the fake opposition between social communication and individual independence is due to an absenteeism of, or a taboo on, that one great force signifying social attraction. This source does not consist of language, which is merely a means of communication, but of exactly that type of eroticism which generally is tabooed by rational scientific writing. It is a kind of eroticism which has little or nothing to do with sexuality, as it is without the highlight of the inevitable ultimate climax of truth. Rather, It is an eroticism which does not hunt from the will to know, but embraces the process of touching, neither of souls nor bodies, but one of shared dreams, the will to communicate. My friend and I, as no two individuals can be, neither happen to be of the same nature. In the case of me and my friend, we resort to metaphors and metonyms, as these are more erotic in the dynamic sense than the absenteeism of physical communication caused by the true nature or the climax of truth in scientific texts. Anthropology, I believe, should enliven humanistic relationship, though many times this is overlooked by the blur of anthropological and linguistic evidence which seeks to justify the coming of truth. The character of my meetings with this friend resembles what you wrote on poetry, which is: poetry does not exist in its symbolical, visual form. Like music, it addresses itself solely to the inner ear. As you say, music, like poetry, seems to express emotion, not concept. I must say that I have taken your work rather serious, and a great many others did also. More attention is given these days towards the meaning of individuality in history. Nevertheless, as much as I would wish for a social science to be accumulative in terms of knowledge and the improvement of social life in terms of genuine culture, it simply turned out differently. The conventional dodging of the personal still is used as a weapon against originality. I cannot say that I am surprised. It was inevitable. Homologous to the disappropriation of culture through the production of capital, words too have been disappropriated from life contexts into death percepts. I would like to utter that abstraction belongs to the people. Would it not be that such utterance has such ironic connotation? The American social scientific tradition, meanwhile, reveals its own drama. Academic life is now fully economized, and scientists have a tendency, and are also forced, to involve themselves more in financial politics, granting themselves their own private networks rather than opening up research programs. The domination of scientific discourse, the naturalistic discourse, has had devastating effects on anthropology, but simultaneously led it into a healthy crisis. The state of affairs concerned the general direction of scientific discourse has been described by Steven Tyler as: the preferred trope is mechanistic rationality, which focuses on the relation of parts to parts, requires strict separation of fact and value, of cognitive from non-cognitive, of objectivity from subjectivity, of demonstration from persuasion, is projected from the autonomous perspective of an observer who is outside the field of observation, affects it minimally by his presence or her presence, and attempts no fusion of relative perspective. As a result, on the one hand, characterizations which tend to be mostly generalizing representations of reductionist categories have been under critique within cultural anthropology during the last 20 years at least. In fact, representation itself has been under attack. It is both part of the movement that you and Boas set in motion, as well as post-war decolonizing processes that led to radical re-evaluation of the Western-oriented side of anthropology. Studies nowadays do not pretend to be representations anymore, but rather interpretations. They centralize dialogue between researchers and informants, and an attempt to change the world through reflective or critical anthropology, like, for instance, Dwyer. The general idea of objective research has been deconstructed as a result of postmodernist approaches. which rather view various forms of expressive representation as simultaneously existing rather than as mutually exclusive. Since the early 80s, a bit begrudgingly, poetry too has become such a mode of expression. Yet, simultaneously, I found that figurative meanings, apart from those contributed by the master trope itself, are prohibited, as also Steven Tyler writes, in many fields of institutional anthropology still. Maybe even as a result from this institutional prohibition of figurative speech, on the other hand, studies concerning the relation between individual and society have increasingly befallen the fate of a psychological reduction. One might say that the expression of individuals as individuals is only allowed as a cultural institution with a match, set and done figure of cultural characteristics. The quest for the American cultural tradition set the pace for a preoccupation by American social scientists to also talk about the American character, much like the culture and personality school did. And, as a result nowadays, more attention is given to your work on culture and personality. So much that even your seminars have been reconstructed with the aid of notebooks of your students. And they have been published as a book which is called Psychology of Culture. You understand, lots of speculation has been going on about the meaning of your work, and in spite of the fact that you once expressed, we can never know or afford to know the whole truth about personality. Simultaneously, other scientists have used your work, especially your linguistic work, as the basis of modeling phonetics and structuring the unconscious. Some even believe that you are very enthusiastic about Carl Gustav Jung. However, all I could find was a courteous treatment of his work on psychological types that also warned us, by you, for the dangerous effects of typologies, which is much more in line with your above statements. But you would not believe how popular psychoanalysis has become in the United States. Gruber, who failed to introduce the practice of psychoanalysis in the USA, would have made big money had he lived today. The role of psychoanalysis in the United States has become an entirely new survival through adaptation strategy. With the disappearance of the objectivist ideal, the form of scientific texts is no longer stable. Experiments are being done with fiction, film, and transcription. And in spite of all this, the result of textualization and conceptualization through language has not been overcome in social science. Once you warned us, writing, language is heuristic in a much more far-reaching sense than it predetermines for us certain modes of observation and interpretation. This means, of course, that as our scientific experience grows, we must learn to fight the implications of language. But fighting the implications of language is easier said than done. Though part, of course, this problem is the result of the textual nature of social science, the other part is the result of the general idea of justification, which still dominates anthropology, in spite of its experimental forms. In this sense, the central problem of individual representation in anthropology really did not change at all since you died. It still privileges rationality above emotion and generality above individual creativity. The question remains how to retrieve this beautiful idea of cultural vividness that you call genuine. As you have put it so plain at one of time in your courses of lectures on the psychology of culture, culture is sometimes not rich enough to give an individual an opportunity for expression.